Let me ask you this. If you don't know who you are, how are you going to help yourself? That's the first question. If I don't know who I am, I mean, presumably we live our life in such a way as to enrich and to help ourselves along and to improve ourselves. Now, if we don't know who we are, how are we going to do that? And then the corollary to that is, along with improving ourselves, we all have a compassionate nature, we have a compassionate side to ourselves, we have empathy for others, and generally a lot of our activities, at least the better part of it, are engaged in improving other people's lives and helping them out. So if we don't know who we are, how are we going to help ourselves out, and how are we going to help anyone else out? So wouldn't it behoove us, before we start on this journey called life, to figure out the most basic axiomatic truth? If you're a mathematician, you need to get your axioms right. You don't start off a long, complicated equation that covers 20 blackboards without checking that your basic axioms are right. If you started out 2 plus 2 equals 5, then no matter how brilliant you are after that, everything's going to be off. So we need to figure out who we are before we even do anything. We need to figure out what is the basic axiom of our existence. And that starts with the question, who am I? And how I am going to answer that question is the subject matter of our talk today. These are based on the teachings of the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We had a yoga retreat last weekend, and we had some really interesting people. We had a world religions professor from Weber State University and his wife. We had a lot of interesting people on the yoga retreat, and we went up to Spanish Fork Reservoir and up higher to Lookout Point. We found a little shady place. We had a picnic lunch, and then we broke out our copies of the Bhagavad Gita. And I invite a guest yoga teacher up from Newport Beach every time we have a yoga retreat. His name is Alan. And he has a little bit of different schooling than I do in Indian culture. He's what we call an impersonalist, and we're personalists. And so I always invite Alan to present the opposite point of view, and we have a mock debate. And it's fun and it's instructive for the people that happen to be there. So we opened the Bhagavad Gita and we started reading a verse in the 10th chapter where Prabhupada asserts that Krishna, whom you see, his figure on the altar, the darkish figure plan, is God. And then he quotes about 20 verses from the Sanskrit scriptures, from the Vedic scriptures, giving the Sanskrit itself. So we read all those, and then I gave the example of a lawyer in the courtroom. A lawyer who presents himself before the judge and the jury and all the witnesses and all the press, there's a huge assembly of resources in the courtroom. You know, a single day of trial costs tens of thousands of dollars. People do not want to waste their time. So what is it incumbent upon the lawyer to do? What is all his training prepare him to do? It is to quote from what's called obiter dictum, to quote the body of law in order to support his arguments. As soon as he says, well, I think this, or maybe it should be like that, or perhaps we could do this, then he's wasting everybody's time. And the judge quite possibly could get very angry at him. So we were having this discussion. Prabhupada was giving all these quotes. Merlin and Jenna were there. And Alan was saying nothing. He was saying nothing. And I was prodding, Alan, say something, you know. And we came back. I said, Alan, why don't you say? He said, well, it was so authoritative. I mean, it was so authoritative. Everything that he said was backed up by Scripture. And in fact, in the purport, Prabhupada said, if you don't back up your statements about the nature of the self and the nature of God by Scripture, then you're a fool. And that's pretty much what a judge might call a so-called lawyer in the courtroom who's just making it up as he goes along. He's a fool because he's wasting everyone's time and he's not presenting anything authoritative. So we're going to present the nature of the soul not on speculation, maybes or mights or perhapses, but we're going to base it on the authority of the Vedic scriptures. This is a question that all intelligent people should be asking. Who am I? And there are various answers. And I'll tell you right now, I'll just give you a little hint. Every one of the answers that you're going to see flashing before you is wrong. And I'll stop at the end and I'll ask if anyone would like to venture an opinion on why all these different designations are incorrect. That in fact, if you identify yourself primarily, of course, for social intercourse, we have to call ourselves by these various designations and so on and so forth. But if these are the prime way that you identify yourself, then you're wrong. I'm a designer, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a sportsman, I'm a musician, I'm a husband, I'm a wife, I'm father, I'm a son, I'm an American, I'm Japanese, I'm Chinese, I'm Christian, I'm Muslim, I'm Hindu. And here's all the different, you know, once you get into Hinduism, you get all the different Gujarati, Mumbaite, Kannada, Rajasthan, and so on and so on. We could do the same thing in America. I'm a Georgian, I'm a Floridian, I'm a Utahn. But what are all these answers have in common? What's the common feature in each and every one of these designations? They're based on the body, are they not? And what is the body? What is the body? The body is temporary, is it not? If you go to medical school, one of the first things you'll learn is that every 7 to 10 years, all the cells of your body will die and be replaced by a new one. So how many cells do we have in our bodies? Anyone know? I mean, it's probably in the billions. Probably in the many, many billions. So if over the course of 7 years, maybe 2,000 days, every single one of those billions of cells will have died and been replaced by new ones, that means there's a lot of cells dying every day. There's hundreds of thousands of cells dying every day. In fact, every minute, there's probably tens of thousands of cells dying. Every second, there are probably thousands of cells dying. The body is temporary. If you live 80 years, you'll have had 10 complete different changes of body. But do you feel that you're temporary? Do you feel that you're temporary? Do you feel that you're the body? If someone says, I'm this body, and at the present moment, the body that you're in, I see some aunts and uncles and grandfathers here. So someone may say, I am a grandfather. I am 65 years old, and I have white hair, and I have spectacles. Okay, but is that how you described yourself 20 years ago? Is that how you described yourself 20 years ago, 30 years? I am a grandfather, I have white hair and I have spectacles. I venture to guess that you described yourself totally differently 20 years ago. And you may again describe yourself 20 years from now, you'll still be a grandfather, but you're more likely to be calling yourself a great-great-great-grandfather. So the body is temporary, but you're still the same person. You're just in a different body, whether it be young or old. Whatever your land of your birth may be, whatever your occupation may be, whatever your belief system is, it's going to change. It's going to change. But the problem is that you don't change. And we can see this very easily in our common parlance. This is my nose. This is my nose. These are my ears. This is my hand. This is my shirt. The question is, who am I? Who am I? This is my body. I don't say I body because I'm not the body. If I was the body, I'd say I body, I businessman, I man, I woman. But I don't. I say my body, my hands, my eyes. So the question should arise, who is the possessor? Who is that entity that possesses the body, that possesses the hands, that uses the eyes? David Hume, a great educator from England, he says, I can see my hand, but can my hand see me? Well, who is that seer? Question. Do the eyes see? We commonly say, oh, with my eyes I saw the mountains. Do the eyes really see? Is that a fact? Do the eyes see? Because after you, as a spiritual entity, leave your body, the same eyes are going to be there. But are they going to be seen? If not, then what was it that was actually seen? It was not the eyes. It was you seeing through the eyes. Just like these windows don't see, they don't have the capacity of vision, but we can see through the windows. These eyes do not have the capacity to see. But But they will allow us to see through them, through their translucency. So the question is, who is that seer? Here are the analytical, scientific constituents of your body. You've got lime and fat, enough lime and fat in your body to make 7 bars of soap. You've got enough phosphorus in your body to make 20 matchboxes. You've got enough water in your body to fill a 10-gallon tank, as well as a little sulfur, calcium, and some other trace elements. You've got enough iron in your body to make 6 small nails, enough carbon to make 900 pencils, enough sugar to sweeten 10 cups of coffee, and enough potassium to fire a toy cannon. The total value of all this is about $20. $20. So if you're the body, why are these people crying? Why are they crying? They're crying. If you lose, my wife went to the Culver City one time. We were living in the LA Temple for 10 years. And there's a hardware store. She went across the street. She wanted to buy something for $20. And she's there at the counter. And I don't know what she did, but apparently she left the $20 on the counter, turned back, and it was gone. $20 was gone like that. She came back and she described it to me, but she wasn't tear-soaked, she wasn't sobbing, she wasn't pulling out of her hair, she wasn't wailing, you know, and scoring her breast with agony, because it was only $20. So why are these people crying if we're only $20? See? Here's a wreck. A BMW has just gotten smashed, and presumably there was someone in the BMW that got smashed. Now, wouldn't the BMW be more valuable? BMW is worth $50,000. The body of the person in the BMW is only worth $20. There's something askew here, isn't there? There's something we're missing, isn't there? Or should I say, the materialistic scientists are missing something. Consciousness doesn't come from matter. It does not arise from matter. Life comes from life. Life doesn't come from matter. And this is what I said here before. Imagine you have a house, a brick house, and every day you replace one brick. The house would preserve the same basic form, but it really wouldn't be, you know, over the course of 7 to 10 years, it really wouldn't be the same house day after day after day after day. Similarly, the body that you have today is not exactly the same body you had yesterday. Tomorrow's body will be slightly different. It may preserve the same shape and form. Your kids recognize you. Your schoolmates that you have 3 or 4 classes a week in common with, they recognize you. The changes are not that dramatic, and they're not discernible by the naked eye. But let's say you had an aunt when you were 5 years old, and you spent every day at her house. She lived near you. You spent every day at her house. Then she went to Europe, and she's been in Europe for the last 15, 20 years. And for some reason, there have been no exchange of pictures or emails or communications. She has not seen you for 20 years. So you go to meet her at the airport, in LaGuardia Airport, and you happen to be with a bunch of your school friends. Your aunt may very well not be able to pick you out of the crowd, because your body has changed so drastically, several times, in fact, during the course of those 20 years. This is the instructions of Lord Krishna. And it's interesting that the Bhagavad Gita contains 18 chapters. The knowledge of the soul, where do you think you're going to find it? Take a guess. If you haven't read the Bhagavad Gita, in what part of the Bhagavad Gita do you think you're going to find the answer to the question, who are you? Huh? The middle. Any other guesses on that? The first, right in the beginning. Because just like we said before you came in, that's the first question you have to deal with in life. Because based on your answer to that question, you're going to do everything right or you're going to do everything wrong. So Krishna, he's our well-wishing friend, he wants us to get it right. So he doesn't waste any time. There's the first chapter talks about the situation, sets the scene, And then bam, within the first 12 verses of the second chapter, Lord Krishna is immediately talking about the soul. And he says, as the embodied soul continually passes in this